wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, and streaming at kboo.fm. This is Lori Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning we provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. Today's Solstice show focuses on the climate crisis and the role of capitalism in propagating it and other cultural myths that help sustain its grip on our political, economic, and social systems. First, the Mole's Bill Resnick talks with John Bellamy Foster from the University of Oregon, whose latest essay in the monthly review, On Fire This Time, examines climate change, the inability of capitalism to respond, and what can be done to make revolutionary change before it's too late. Next, Jan Hocken interviews Grace Nozick about her Ava of the Gaia trilogy, a hopeful climate fantasy series for young readers. Nozick is completing her law degree at the University of British Columbia and is co-founder of the UBC Climate Hub. She talks about the place of fantasy fiction in confronting the hard realities of climate change and student climate activism. Finally, the Mole's Joe Clement and Denise Morris provide some historical and political context for one of the more ubiquitous symbols of this time of year, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. They review the Rankin-Bass stop-motion animated Christmas story, Rudolph, that originally aired on NBC in 1964, and what it tells us about Santa, his elves and reindeer, and messages about social integration. Now, here's Bill Resnick with John Bellamy Foster.
Hi, John Bellamy Foster. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello. Glad to be here.
John Bellamy Foster teaches at the University of Oregon. He writes a lot, including upcoming books, The Robbery of Nature, and then after that, in the next 6 months, The Return of Nature. He edits the journal Monthly Review, making it into a go-to source for thinking about climate change, about the inability of capitalism to respond, about the need for revolutionary change, and about what can be done to make that revolution before it is too late and time is ticking away. In his latest essay in Monthly Review, John Bellamy Foster examines our current period, seeing in it the beginnings of an ecological revolution, and he speculates on the likely future, how that revolution will develop. John, first, summarize your contention. It's the first sentence of your latest essay, On Fire This Time. I quote that sentence now. We are seeing today what appears to be the beginning of an ecological revolution, a new historical moment unlike any humanity has experienced.
Well, you know, when we talk about a revolution, it doesn't necessarily mean that the revolution will be victorious, although the very fact of a revolution means that people believe that they can carry out change. But what we're seeing something quite different now in the face of the seriousness of climate change and the planetary environmental crisis in general and the shortage of time. I mean, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, came out with a report in October 2018 that said that we had to reduce our carbon emissions by almost 50% by 2030, which is, of course, only a decade away. And this has ignited action all over the world. And when I wrote this piece, I was thinking of a number of things. Naomi Klein's book On Fire and the IPCC reports on climate change and the rise of Extinction Rebellion, particularly in Britain, and the radical Green New Deal proposals and the rise of the student movement galvanized by Greta Thunberg, and millions of people suddenly on the march over climate change, and all of this has happened within a year. So things have started to move. They're changing very rapidly. We don't know what this means. Capital, the organized interests at the top of society are moving in a quite different direction. But we are approaching a fundamental period of struggle.
As I was reading that, there's a couple things that I'm optimistic, at least, that you didn't include. One of them is that we know now that we have all of the technologies. They're mostly now off the shelf. We have all the know-how, almost all the know-how. Battery technology is still a problem, towards very, very rapidly moving to reduce carbon pollution, carbon dioxide emissions, methane emissions. I mean, that's one piece of it. There's engineering plans. Bottle cities are developing in some places. In particular, for me in California, now half of the electricity customers in California are now being served by public utilities, either the municipal old municipal utilities of Los Angeles and Sacramento and San Francisco and 40-some others across the state, but also by community energy projects that have grown up in the last 10 years and have taken about a quarter of the customers now from the investor-owned utilities, who are mad as hell and furious, and they can't stop it. Those public utilities are trying to build out the Green New Deal even before the Green New Deal was proposed. That is, when you look at their mission statements, they're quite radical. I think that's a very hopeful sign, actually, is what's happening at the local level in a lot of places.
Yeah, I think that's a sign of people trying to take things into their own hands and move away from corporate governance, and that's exactly the direction things need to go. The idea of the Green New Deal has been around for a long time, as I explain in my article on Fire This Time, but it's only in very recently, first with the Green Party and then more recently with AOC's resolution, that the Green New Deal has been put on a different basis, a radical basis. So it combines the notion of having to take the actions necessary to combat climate change and combine them with a just transition. It's the combination of the two, the action on climate change and a just transition for frontline communities, that makes the Green New Deal so radical and also so meaningful. It makes it into a real possibility because it's linked to mobilization of the population around these issues. There's no doubt we have all the tools we need to deal with climate change. It's been obvious for a long time. It's not just a question of technology. It's a question of social action. We reduce emissions not simply by adopting new technologies, but also by taking actions that are actually much more effective to organize our society more rationally and justly. And we can reduce emissions very rapidly by reducing the waste and inequality in our society that requires this high level of emissions.
Yeah, and use reduction is a way of the capital costs of conversion can be cut in half if you cut in half the waste and reduce use and conserve. It seems to me, and that really is a huge social project that has to be done by everybody. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to John Bellamy Foster, who teaches at the University of Oregon in Eugene. He writes books, produces great students. He is also the editor of Monthly Review. It comes out monthly, of course, which has become a go-to source for those of us who are committed to system change, not climate change. In this interview, we have so far established that we are now in and living the beginnings of an ecological revolution. The people who run things, the powers that be, have their own plan. And John Bellamy Foster's talked about the Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez proposals for Green New Deal, that they outline a transformational program. John, I hope we can get into the stages of that revolution. How is it going to proceed? How will it likely occur? And since there's not much time, how we can speed it along?
Well, yeah, I think the Green New Deal is, at least in this part of the world, an organizing principle. And that what makes it so powerful is, of course, it's about the mobilization of the population and recognizing that the problem of climate change is also a problem of a just transition in society. Once you start putting those things together, you have something that's significant. But we have to move very rapidly. The only realistic plan that coming out of the Green New Deal is the one offered by Bernie Sanders, which, you know, requires an investment of $16 trillion and really goes after the fossil fuel industry, makes capital pay for it, redistributes funds to countries in the global south so they can reduce their emissions. It is an ambitious program that's connected with uniting with labor and frontline communities in terms of a just transition. And it's quite apart from the fact that Sanders is running for president. I don't want to emphasize that right now, but the fact is this is the only kind of plan that we have on the table that has any kind of realism to it whatsoever, because of the scale of the problem. If we look at, let's say, how do we reduce federal government emissions, carbon emissions, which are a very big part of U.S. emissions? Well, 80% of the federal government carbon emissions are associated with the military, or are directly the result of the military. We can shift our priorities, and we can move towards mobilizing population, like in the New Deal era, even as in some ways in terms of mobilization in the Second World War. But it has to be more of a bottom-up mobilization. People have to get involved in this change and recognize that we can't do it without actually very large change in our society. And this is not just a radical conception. It's something that scientists are saying in mass as well at this point. There is no other way. I tend to think of it in terms of a two-stage process. Ultimately, the solutions are eco-socialist in the sense that we have to reorganize the structure of our society absolutely fundamentally to emphasize people's needs and use value rather than exchange value, and to no longer make profit the main criteria of our society, but rather people on the planet. But we're not ready, of course, for that full eco-socialist change right now, but we need to implement really radical or revolutionary reforms that are possible in the present, that I think of as in terms of an eco-democratic movement that comes first. We're so much up against the wall that we're approaching the cliff at such a rapid rate that we're less than 15 years away from 2 degrees Celsius increase in carbon emissions, or the trillionth ton of emissions. We're less than 15 years away now at the current rate of emissions. And so we have to slow that train down. We have to pull the emergency brake and then figure out how we're going to reorganize society to make it serve the interests of people. And one thing is for sure, it doesn't serve the interests of the population if we destroy the planet on which everyone depends.
And pulling that emergency brake, the powers that be, in my sense, is they've changed their tune. Even the fossil fuel industries are now greenwashing and touting ExxonMobil research into alternative energy sources. Every sports event I watch, not too many, thank goodness, nowadays, but they have their commercial on. I think they've moved away from climate change, abandoned climate change denial as a central tactic. And they're now into greenwashing, and in fact, they're into making an effort to profit from climate change by developing all these new technologies, and all of them are in trouble now, like the investor-owned utilities and the automobile firms. I have a sense that they are in Washington, D.C., in fact, I know they are in Washington, D.C., supporting a huge federal project for taxpayer paying for the big grid that the investor-owned utilities absolutely require if they want to survive. It's a trillion-dollar investment. Electric rates would go sky high if they had to pay for it. And they want the federal government to pay for it. The coal companies want research into clean coal. They have a lot of support in Congress for carbon sequestration, geoengineering, the engineering labs. It seems to me that there's a whole push on now by capital to sort of take over the climate change problem and make it a profit center. How do we stop that? And they're going to win some of the battles. How do we keep going in the face of what is going to be a corporate offensive to brand themselves as the people who are going to stop climate change?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that none of that's going to work in terms of solving climate change. I mean, certainly technology is involved, but you're talking about a strategy of capitalist ecological modernization, and that emphasizes technology rather than changing any of the social parameters, rather than changing power relations, rather than having people mobilize, rather than making this a full-scale effort of the society. They want to promise to do it by technological means through the market, which would flow into the coffers of capital, enhance their profit. But they're not really promising, and they cannot do anything to stop the problem. You can't stop the problem unless the fossil fuels stay in the ground. And the fastest way to do that is a full-scale national effort and mobilization, and also it would involve some conservation, and it would require redistribution. It would require going against capital and all of that they're opposed to. You know, in a war, like in the Second World War, it was sort of understood that you want to avoid war profiteering, right, where basically capital corporations come in and they profit off of the war effort rather than contributing to it. It becomes just another market for them. The one thing they don't want to do is to change any of the fundamental relationships. And we're not seeing a movement anywhere against the fossil fuels. It's simply a zero-sum equation. If we burn the fossil fuels, we're going to destroy the Earth as a place of human habitation. And the corporations are not going to lead the way in stopping that, because they're tied into the whole fossil fuel financial industrial complex. If you want to read something about the corporate or the strategy of capital in this, I recommend an article by James Plested that came out on December 10th in Red Flag in Australia, called How the Rich Plan to Rule a Burning Planet. If you want to read something scary, there is a sense in which the prevailing interests are willing to fiddle while Rome burns.
Yeah, and sacrifice most of the population. I'm sure that's in the article. John Bellamy Foster, you know, we've sort of come to a conclusion, a lot of conclusions. There's a lot of work ahead for a lot of people. We really do have to mobilize from below. The capitalist, quote, solution will prove absolutely fruitless in time, and people will recognize it, and then will hopefully come this vast mobilization. It'll still be a period of the beginnings of ecological revolution. It'll get stronger even during a period maybe where capital make some gains and profits, especially out of climate change. But the people are going to realize they're hopeless. And at that point, it seems to me, we will see a sort of Pearl Harbor awakening.
Problem is the time factor. What the science says is that 2 degrees Celsius is likely, or even before that, the point of no return or the point of irreversibility. That is, we will lose control of the situation. And the tipping points right now in Nature, the last month an article came out and said there are 9 tipping points operative. If the tipping points take over, then the whole climate system will be propelled out of control, and we will not be able to control the situation simply by reducing our emissions. We'll be propelled to higher temperatures. So what we have to do is avoid that planetary tipping point or point of irreversibility. But right now, at the current rate of emissions, it's only 14 years away. After that, if the population of the world wakes up too late, we might have no options left but trying to geoengineer the planet, which is insane. Once things get out of control, there will be a bigger push in that direction, which is actually what capital would like to see.
Yeah.
It's really a question of acting now. There really isn't any time to wait, and we can't wait for the world to wake up. People have to take action and wake the world up.
The world will wake up. We have to prepare the ground for that wake up. That is, we have to keep talking about the threat and its solutions and how capital is going to destroy us if we don't remove them from the seats of power. That's the last word, John. I think we have to sign off. So thank you so much for talking to us today.
Yes, I think you said it exactly right.
Thanks a lot. So long.
I don't want knowledge. I want certainty.
You are listening to KBOO Portland in the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Bill Resnick and John Bellamy Foster. As John Foster reminds us, to bring about a Green New Deal, we need systematic change, a revolution in our society, an eco-democratic movement. We can pull the emergency brake and reorganize society that does not favor capital but people instead. Corporations are not going to lead the way. They are too tied into the fossil fuel system. Next, Jan Hocken interviews Grace Nozick about her Ava of the Gaia trilogy, a hopeful climate fantasy series for young readers, and they discuss the place of fantasy fiction in confronting the hard realities of climate change.
Grace Nozick, welcome to KBOO, Grace Nozick.
Thanks so much. Excited to be here.
Well, you are an author of young adult fiction, the Ava of the Rise trilogy, as well as a researcher at the Climate Lab at the University of British Columbia. And part of that project centers on what the Hub describes as hope-oriented climate change conversations within young communities. So let's start there with that work with students, with youth, and then we'll turn to your fascinating series of eco-fantasy novels, which I've been immersed in over my holiday break.
Sounds great.
Even fascinating for old adults. So let's start with that work at the Climate Hub, particularly the outreach to with youth around the climate issue.
Sure. So the Climate Hub was actually started less than 2 years ago by students at the University of British Columbia, and we advocated for funding from the university for this theory of change that we have. And what it recognizes is that one of the key gaps that we have on climate action is political will. And to build political will on climate change, you really need to make the issue more salient to a broader group of people. And so we have been using young storytellers to reach new communities. All of the students at University of British Columbia have their own communities, all 60,000 of them, and can kind of be these powerful ambassadors. And so we've been really excited about the potential of storytelling to be a critical way to take climate action.
Do you have some examples, and perhaps also could you speak to how some of those stories engage First Nations climate activism, which is very strong and vibrant in British Columbia?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that the Hub does is we run these youth climate ambassador workshops for high school students. So we bring university student facilitators into local high schools. And what we know is that high school students are already really scared. They're already worried about climate change. So we know we don't have to emphasize the urgency or the doom that much. Indeed, we actually think it's a moral prerogative to give these young people a sense of hope that they have a future on this planet. And so we go into these high schools, we offer these free workshops everywhere in Metro Vancouver, and we kind of validate students' emotions, we listen to them, we give these peer-to-peer workshops that define and explain climate justice, because climate is still framed as just an environmental issue most of the time, rather than the biggest human rights issue of our time. And just as you said, we really focus on how Indigenous sovereignty is critical to climate justice and climate action, and that's supporting Indigenous sovereignty and Indigenous self-governance and Indigenous language. Those all are really important climate actions that we young people can take. But we also give the young folks agency. We talk about hope. We talk about building climate community and how you might be able to do that. And then we really focus on systemic change over individual action. And, you know, the social science says that people define environmental citizenship as recycling. They understand that. That's what they've been told decade after decade after decade. And so now we're focusing, instead of on the three R's, on the three V's, which is voice, vote, and volunteer. And so we really emphasize kind of calling your local officials, getting out the vote, supporting land defenders, supporting those on the front line, but that's actually the climate action that we can all take.
Now, some of that involved the resistance to the Trans Mountain pipeline that has disappointed so many people in the Trudeau government, who was exalting himself, putting himself out there as a climate champion, and yet put the pocketbook of the government and citizens behind this hideous pipeline. Has that been an issue there in BC that students have rallied around?
Definitely. We've seen immense kind of mobilization around that issue from young folks. And one of the things that I am so heartened by the youth climate strikers is they really hold up this incredibly intersectional vision of climate action and climate justice. And so they really, in my opinion, center Indigenous voices and really recognize the work that has been going on for centuries by Indigenous land and water defenders. And they also recognize that climate justice encompasses labor issues. At the recent climate strike in Vancouver, the youth climate strike organizers gave a shout out to the hotel workers who were striking across the street. And we've seen them kind of support racial justice as a key part of climate justice and all of these different facets of climate action. And obviously what was so disappointing about Trans Mountain was that popular support, you know, there had been such an incredible grassroots resistance that the corporation was going essentially kind of like, this is too much. And then the government bought the pipeline. And that was a huge you know, really upsetting, I think, to folks in BC.
Yeah, and also I think for many is further confirmation of the limits of the leaders to do the right thing, short of mass movements standing in the way of it.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that the Climate Hub thinks is that we have to, you know, it's incredibly disappointing when leaders make the decisions that they do, and we can hold them accountable on their climate inaction. But at the same time, building the political will and creating space for climate leaders is going to be so important for the future, and that, at least in the U.S., climate still ranks very low on the list of issues that voters care the most about when they go to the ballot. And so really bringing that up closer to the top is such an important part of the work.
So let's talk about your trilogy, because it's described as an eco-fantasy novel. The first of the three books starts in like a high school, I guess, in some town in New England, and girl meets boy, and there's a love interest that's kind of beautifully drawn out, because the protagonist, Ava, is very big and strong, but someone who, a head turner as well when she walks in a room. And so, but their love interest also has this element of attraction across tribal differences. They come out of different orders in medieval times, so there is that medieval world that still inhabits the present. Can you say a little bit about how you understand her also as a warrior, because warriorship also is something that's still part of indigenous discourse on the climate, water warriors and land warriors. So is your work and how you frame the warfare between two worldviews that these characters carry, how you understand that as part of climate, your climate work?
Sure, yeah. So as I mentioned, I do think storytelling is one of the most critical things that we can all do. And so obviously I've really leaned into that. And I should also just say it's been so joyful for me to do this. And one of the things that we also really encourage in our movement is take what you want to learn or take what you love and bring it to the movement. So if you want to be writing, or if you want to be doing poetry or making music, to really capture that synergy and bring your joy and your energy and your growth to the movement. So we've been doing a lot of work with artists and athletes and people who want to bring and grow their skills in the movement, which has been joyful. And then Ava, which you're exactly right, is this story about kind of this clash between two ancient orders, the Ares and the Gaia, both with these supernatural powers. And the Ares are kind of, you know, have unlocked every corner of the brain and really turned inwards and garnered the wisdom of humanity. And the Gaia have really honed their connection with the natural world. And they used to be powerful allies, but with kind of the rise of industrial age and climate change and nuclear weapons, they're fighting. And I guess this story of the attraction and the love was in some way trying to say we can still bring a rapprochement between those two ways of being. More that, you know, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, I guess, but that there is still a way to come together around those things. And I weave so many of the issues that I've studied, because I'm a lawyer, and now I'm getting my PhD in law, and I've gotten a master's of law, and I wrote some of these while I was in school, and some professors even allowed me to get credit for writing these stories, because making the ideas that I was learning, which were so powerful, accessible to the public seemed like such an important part of my scholarship. And so I've woven kind of geoengineering and climate justice and interspecies connection into the book as a way to start some conversations with the public. And then when I was writing my third book, I was so lucky. I was at the University of Victoria, and I got to intern or volunteer with the Indigenous Law Research Unit at UVic, who are doing incredible work supporting the revitalization of Indigenous law and Indigenous legal systems across Canada, and made some wonderful mentors there. And they really challenged me to think about how to center or hold up Indigenous law in my writing and in all of the other projects that I do. And so they helped me kind of work some of that into the third novel. So yeah, covering a lot of ground.
Yeah, my team and I have interviewed a number of Indigenous climate activists and water protectors who talked about the eagle and the condor legend. And I was reminded of that when I was reading your series, this prophecy that has to do with two worldviews that where the one became dominant, the very technologically driven worldview, and that there is in the prophecy a calling for some kind of balance. Of course, it doesn't carry you very far in thinking about how capitalism is a very complicated system that is not just about finding balance, but overturning an order. But it seems that you work with some of those ideas. Was that at all conscious, that prophecy that's been important in some Indigenous communities, the eagle and the condor?
I've never heard that prophecy, because I think there's more than 500 legal systems, Indigenous legal systems, in Canada alone, and each has their own, like, origin stories and their legal principles. And so, yeah, that I would be very interested to hear that one.
Yeah, we'll have to talk more about that. There is this, both this idea of struggle, warriorship, fighting for a better and a just world, but also something about balance, too, coming into harmony and balance with the natural order. You seem to be, these are themes you work with.
Yeah, and I definitely, like, interspecies connection is a huge part of my books, because I don't see that very often, and that real kind of celebration of animal and human connection.
That's part of the Gaia principle, isn't it? The Gaia principle as a tradition of thought.
Yes, exactly.
So you draw on that and bring that into science. Well, I so much appreciate your coming on to the Omal Variety Hour this morning. And just in closing, how can people get a copy of this riveting trilogy that I swear you will not be able to put it down over your holiday break?
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that, Jen. Yeah, so it was really important for me to make the books accessible. So they're actually free as an ebook, kind of wherever you can download ebooks. And you can find all those links at www.genosic.com with a bit more about the books and kind of why I chose to write them that way. But thank you so much, Dan. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, yeah, and we so much look forward to continuing to hear about your work. And there's a lot on the Climate Hub online as well. So this is Jan Hocken talking this morning with Grace Nosek, author of Young Adult Fiction, the Ava Gaia series, as well as a researcher at the Climate Hub at the University of British Columbia. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Jan. Definitely will.
Okay. Okay. Take care. Bye.
You too.
Well, thank you, Jan Hocken and Grace Nosek, for that thoughtful discussion of the intertwining possibilities of eco-fantasy fiction and youth climate activism. Next, The Moles' Joe Clement and Denise Morris provide some important insights about the seemingly benign but propagandistic messages of familiar holiday cultural symbols.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is quintessential capitalist American Christmas lore. Originally conceived in 1939 by Robert L. May for a Montgomery Ward's Christmastime coloring book, the timeless song most of us know wasn't written until the late 40s by May's brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, which would be sung into history by famous country music star Gene Autry in 1949. Over a decade later, a new version of the story was created for television. The 1964 stop-motion Animagic Productions were created by Tadahito Mochinaga under the auspices of the Rankin and Bass Production Company, and both developed and added to the story. It begins narrated by a talking snowman voiced by Burl Ives. Rudolph is born to Donner, one of the eight reindeer famously named in Clement Clark Moore's 1820s poem A Visit from St. Nicholas, or 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. His red nose is immediately and cruelly deprecated by his father, who vows to hide it and forces Rudolph to smear mud on it. A year later, Rudolph is at the famous reindeer games, and the fake nose his father fashions for him to wear falls off, exposing his nose and earning the astoundingly unchecked derision of everyone, including the coach, the other young reindeer, and Santa himself. The first character to be nice to him is a young doe, Clarice, who says she loves how his red nose makes him different. When her father breaks the two of them up, though, he wanders off feeling ostracized. Then he meets a wholly new character, a misfit elf named Hermie, who hates making toys and really wants to be a dentist. So they run away together. After a while, they meet Yukon Cornelius, a burly gun-toting prospector who claims to own the land he searches for silver and gold on. After a brush with the Christmas-hating abominable snowman, also later known as the Bumble, they escape on an ice float and drift to the island of Misfit Toys, a kind of purgatory for defective toys Santa hasn't but might deliver. Ruled by the flying, lying king Moonraiser, almost straight out of a C.S. Lewis novel, they're allowed to stay temporarily, but Rudolph leaves his friends in the night, afraid of endangering them with his nose. Cut to the next year, Rudolph is a more grown-up stag who returns to Christmastown only to set back out in search of his parents, who were lost looking for him in the previous year. He goes to the Bumbles' cave to rescue them, only to get rescued by Hermie, who defangs the Bumbles with his dentist equipment, and Yukon, who wrestles him off a cliff. When they return to Christmastown, everyone apologizes to the misfits for being jerks and promises to do better, and the night before Christmas, Santa asks Rudolph to guide his sleigh in the blizzard, and the rest, they say, is history. Denise, you asked me to review this movie. What prompted you to do that?
First, I have always been inspired by the piece that you did with a guest on The Old Mole back in 2015, which was the Charlie Brown Christmas. And it was a great assessment of a long, enduring, favorite animation that many of us have probably watched over and over again throughout our lives. And I have to admit, I still watch it a little more knowingly now. And so in a sense, that's kind of what happened to me with Rudolph. I do a little babysitting here and there and found myself watching Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer a few weeks ago. And I thought to myself, this is really terrible. So I have a bit of grief in facing what we're about to do. We dissect Rudolph in a way that illuminates its underside. But what really pushed me to want to review it was the point at which we are told the abominable hates Christmas. And then I remembered the abominable has its teeth removed and becomes part of the Christmas family. And that's where I realized that this sense of the outsider, the difference, the nonconformity of Rudolph and Hermie, Yukon Cornelius, and the Bumble isn't exactly a heartwarming tale, that there's deep social and political side to dig up.
Yeah, one parody trailer production company, Honest Trailers, did some work on this, and they make a point that I agree with, that in the end, they very superficially apologize and recognize how they wronged their respective different people from the story, but it's not really that deep. We're supposed to feel like this means something, but it is really awkward if we actually try to connect with it on that level.
Something I find really interesting about Rankin and Bass is the shows, particularly Rudolph, Santa Claus is Coming to Town, Year Without a Santa Claus, all stop motion. They all build their storyline around crisis, and the crisis being whether or not goods can be delivered, and also the origin tale of Santa Claus, the Burgermeister outlaws toys. But there's a crisis around Christmas that by the end, it gets restored. In the case of Rudolph, the story of his nonconformity or his difference does put a wrench in what could probably otherwise be a more easily digestible story. Interestingly, the crisis is often brought on by an impenetrable storm, a blizzard. And in our modern lens, of course, we could make quite a lot out of that particular element.
Yeah, climate crisis is kind of very weirdly resonant in this film, when in a time when they probably did not actually even begin to perceive what we see possibly coming now. But there is a crisis in whether Santa is going to be able to fulfill the duty of taking out all the gifts. And this is 1964, so we're already in the 60s, and we already had 10 years of a post-war boom at least. It's when things are starting to slow down, or they will be slowing down in the next few years. And there's a crisis of the culture and people's rejection of conformity and of the industrial system. And I think the film is kind of trying to take that up, and its trajectory is ultimately that we need to be able to accommodate difference in order to keep the machine going, because in the end, it's about keeping Santa going.
The show makes very clear that there are roles that people play, particularly around gender. We have female elves all in pink. We have Clarice, the young doe of note in Rudolph's life, who loves his nose and actually accepts him, but is relegated to the sidelines and not able to help because Donner is the big guy and he's going to go save Rudolph.
Donner, Rudolph's dad, is just really cruel and abusive to him. And there's this weird selfishness that is vaguely aware of status and in that sense like a broader society, but is otherwise very concerned with no buck of mine is going to embarrass me.
And Santa Claus is also portrayed as brutal, really, that Donner should be ashamed of himself because he has this child with this red nose. Rudolph has no place. And really what we're working towards is Rudolph has no place until Rudolph is needed. Up until this point, there's still an opportunity for Rudolph and Hermie the dentist to kind of go off and build their own lives. But one reviewer raises this question, if you don't fit into society, then where is your place? I mean, they live at the North Pole. It makes it a little bit hard. There's monsters out there. It's real cold, you know. But there's nowhere for them to go. Then we have the Island of Misfit Toys, where all of these misfit toys live. I can hardly tell that they're misfits. I mean, I don't have a problem with a polka-dotted elephant.
Or the sentry Jack in the Box that's actually a Charlie in the Box. And it is really kind of apparent that they're traumatized or terrorized by this idea of what it means to fit in, that something silly like a name, which has nothing to do with how a thing works, would somehow make it a misfit.
Yeah, it's interesting because the program lays out this after-school special opportunity, fails completely, and actually reinforces the tenets of capitalist production and belonging based on utility. This has been written about far more than I had expected, and I feel like I was a little bit behind the curve on it. So yeah, I've got my grief going, but it's truly frightening. And I hear I'm watching this with this 21-month-old child, and I'm thinking to myself, I hope she doesn't remember any of this.
I think it's important to just return back to this idea that these aren't really Christmas stories, or Christmas, we have to understand, has departed from the Christian tradition in important senses, which they are complaining about all the time. And a lot of the Christmas specials, I think, are engaging this. But these are myths of capitalism made out of commercial contexts. Another very popular Christmas story in America is Miracle on 34th Street, which movie mole Jan Hocken and I reviewed some years ago, is set in a department store where the idea of generosity and altruism is tested against the idea of selling goods in a marketplace. And this story is not really about the question of Jesus and his movement for whatever goodness he talked about. It is about realigning all of these feelings that we have because of that centuries-old tradition around it with the capitalist commercial project. This is a mythology from a commodity universe, not the human universe.
In Miracle on 34th Street and The Year Without a Santa Claus, Rankin and Bass, the crisis is belief in Santa Claus. And in Miracle on 34th Street, it's kind of interesting because the whole Santa Claus thing is getting in the way of business as usual, or the business of Christmas, because it's the Santa Claus who has to actually prove to everyone that he is the real Santa Claus. And in Year Without a Santa Claus, again, there's no belief in Santa Claus. So Santa Claus's goal is to, rather than being this punishing Santa Claus that we see in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, this Santa Claus is going to great lengths to prove that he actually exists, and that, you know, another part of the Christmas crisis, or capitalist crisis, really, is how do we keep this thing going over and over again? And these stories tell us in these different ways why Christmas is important and why it has to happen.
In the context of capitalism as a global system, the myth of Santa's toy shop is not anything that existed more than 100 years ago. It has a strange resonance with the reality of colonial capitalism that was raging through the 20th century until at least the mid-20th century. Many people point to colonial projects that exist to this day. And that it is, I think, channeling an awareness of that is coming through media and the culture, and giving it a very different form to understand how the capitalist system is producing all of this amazing abundance. Of course, there was more manufacturing and such in the U.S. before neoliberalism really kicked into gear, but this economy ran on a system fueled by colonial extraction.
And our good friend Yukon Cornelius is that person in Rudolph who is going about with his pick looking for silver and gold. There's a whole song dedicated to it. Another interesting tidbit is after the original airing of the show in 1964, the reprise of Hermie and Rudolph singing We're a Couple of Misfits was replaced by a song called Fame and Fortune. I think they felt they had to make their own correction there to further entrench it in the bowels of capitalism.
We'll have to return to some of these topics in our extended conversation that we're going to offer you. But that's all the time we have today. I've been Joe Clement, and this is Denise Morris. We've been talking about the 1964 Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer Animagic Christmas special and a lot of the intersecting culture and history of the times.
Thank you, Joe.
You know you're the mastermind. Run, run, Rudolph. Randolph ain't too far behind. Run, run, Rudolph. Santa's gotta make it to town. Santa, make him hurry. Tell him he can take the freeway down. Run, run, Rudolph, 'cause I'm reeling like a merry-go-round. There's a rock and roll electric guitar. And then away went Rudolph, whizzing like a shooting star. Run, run, Rudolph, Santa let you make it in town.
Well, thanks, Joe Clement and Denise Morris, for that excellent and serious review and critique of Rudolph. That does it for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Laurie Mercier, have been your host today, and we want to thank other contributors, including Bill Resnick, John Bellamy Foster, Jan Hocken, and Grace Nozick. And a special shout-out to Denise Morris, our producer and engineer, Patricia Kohlberg. As always, you can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including links to references from today and the extended discussion by Joe and Denise, just referenced in their review of Rudolph. And you can see there how to follow and contact us at the Old Mole Variety Hour. We will be back next Monday at 9 a.m. And if you're not a KBOO member, please go to the KBOO.fm website and join today. We need your support to keep alternative radio going.